happening coming up.
Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our honorable and noble listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. We're broadcasting from the 52nd floor of One Penn Plaza. We have as our honored guest the president of New York State Dormitory Authority, Paul L. Williams. See, T. Williams, Paul T. Williams. Paul T. Williams. Paul, would you please, President Paul T. Williams, would you please give us an opening statement?
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to be with you today. I am president and chief executive officer of Dormitory Authority of the State of New York. We refer to it these days as DASNY. DASNY is a very interesting entity. We're a public authority with our own board of directors. We're involved in both finance and construction management services. So we issue bonds on behalf of the State of New York and for private not-for-profit colleges and hospitals and other not-for-profits. And we also manage construction projects for public agencies, both at the state level and the local level.
Now, I understand you, if I'm not correct, you are also an attorney, but a practice attorney. Tell us your educational background before you pull
Okay, sure. I am an attorney by trade and practiced for about 30 years before I came to the state service. But I'm a product originally of public schools out of Trenton, New Jersey, and St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up. When I got to high school, I went away to a prep school, a Fort Dexter Academy in New Hampshire. From there to Yale University for my undergraduate work, and after Yale, well, while I was at Yale, I spent a year abroad at the American University in Cairo when I was a junior. And then when I came out of Yale, I went right into law school at Columbia University School of Law here in New York.
And I recall, if I'm correct, you started working for Cora T. Walker. And if you were to tell our audience who is Cora T. Walker, who was Cora T. Walker, and her significance in the Harlem community, and why you would take a career move not going to, I won't name the law firm, but you go and work at a law firm in Walker and Bailey.
Right. That's right. Well, Cora T. Walker was a pioneer in the law here in New York City, actually in the country, when it comes to minority lawyers and women lawyers. And she came out of law school at a period of time when there really weren't any women lawyers, much less minority lawyers in real significant positions in major law firms in this city or in the country. And she had a passion and a vision of building her own law firm as a counterpoint, I guess, to the exclusion that she experienced trying to build a practice the traditional way. And she formed a firm up in Harlem and did an awful lot of great work. So when I was ready to come out of law school, I had a similar vision in my mind, slightly different, because I wanted to build what's referred to or what I refer to as a corporate law firm that would represent businesses and government in a range of different areas. I knew that if I had any hope of building a firm, I needed to get not just experience in the law, I needed to get experience in the business of law. So I knew Cora Walker through my parents. She was actually a schoolmate of my mother's way back in the Bronx growing up as a child. And that's how the opportunity actually came to me. And as I investigated it, I thought it would be the best way for me to do what I wanted to do, which was not just to learn my craft as a lawyer, but to try to understand the business aspects of building a law firm. And actually, it turned out to be a great decision because I was able to fulfill both those objectives over time.
And she had a substantial law practice, unlike many of the lawyers in Harlem at that time. I had to work for most of them, including, I won't name some of them, one of them, a very major, prominent lawyer, still owed me $10, he said, brother, I'm going to still owe it to you. So I clerked for many of them, but I remember Ms. Walker, she was very, she ran a tight firm, work was done on time. Second thing about it, remember, were you there when she hit the Harlem Court? You came after that. Right. And I think the law firm was Walker and Bailey.
Yes, it was.
What? Now, later on, you founded your own law firm, Bea and Harris.
Right.
And that was the 30. Tell us about that law
firm. Well, I mean, that was a great period of my life and a great experience because, as I said, that was my ambition. So, a couple of things happened. Going to Walker and Bailey gave me some experience, practical experience as well as legal experience, but also gave me an opportunity because it was flexible enough for me to do something that really did change my life in a fundamental way, which was going to Albany to become counsel to the Assembly Banking Committee.
Right.
And if I'd gone the traditional firm route, I
wouldn't
have
been able to do that. Mr. Miller, George Miller was the head of the bank.
No, George Miller had been.
Right.
But when I got up there, Denny Farrell was the
right. Head. Right.
And I worked with Denny for 4 years in what essentially was a part-time position. So I was still practicing law, going up there part of the week, serving as counsel to the banking committee. But what that did, it did two really important things. Number one, it opened my life up to build a number of very strong relationships that endure to this day with people in and around government.
Right.
And number two, it was my first exposure to the world of public finance. And up until that point in time, I didn't know anything about public finance. I didn't know anything about municipal bonds.
Mm-hmm.
But that particular position gave me reason to learn more about the business and to come to understand at the time how isolated it was from the very folks who were supposed to be impacted by it, which is, you know, people of the state of New York and all the glorious diversity. So you would work on public finance deals or legislation associated with public finance, and it wouldn't be any. The roads would be full of people, but none of them would be people of color. Very few women, if any, involved in the practice at that time, and it just lit a spark in me to want to get involved in that side of the business.
What I found interesting about the exposure to the other lawyers, soon as they had gotten 2 years out of the DA's office, they ready to run for office. God had said, you decided differently. You were more to be a person of influence as opposed to directly being involved and running for political office.
You know,
is there a political office that's still in your closet?
No. You know, you make me remember, you know, things that I worked through and as I was growing up. You know, I grew up in a very an era of great activism. My parents were both social activists. My family was very active. I was very active from a pretty early age. And one of the things I remember very distinctly, early on, I think right around the time when I was thinking about going to law school, still in college, Ken Gibson, mayor of Newark, New Jersey,
uh-huh.
And he was looking good at the time.
Uh-huh.
They were really the symbols of black executive power at the local level at that time for me. And I remember distinctly thinking to myself, you know, Paul, you know, after seeing what was happening with these brothers in the limelight, I said, you know, you may not really want to be out front in terms of the political process, but you should be the guy in the room helping these folks make some, you know, critical decisions about, you know, whether to go right or left. And that idea stuck with me. So I've never really, although I value political life and I respect those guys in politics who do the right thing, I never had any real burning ambition to run for office.
Well, I think an announcer, religion means a lot. You don't have to worry about Paul. Jesus, we just run it for office. So we can have that. I want to go revisit your law practice with what me and Harris. I think you had reached 31st law firm.
Yeah,
well, like to pass the commercial law firms. I mean, I'm sure you don't want to go into real details of the firm dissolve, but it seems to me that one of the visions that I would love to see is African Americans getting out of political office. We know that Carl Moses Brown got out on office. She had no job. What is our dear brother, Curtis Smoke, another Yaley. He's got no job offer. I think we're still in this era where we have to create our own firms that does the good work, but also offer opportunities for our young people. You get a comment on that where you see William and Harris and
mm-hmm. Well, I think that it still remains critical. If you think about the prospect of the black community in particular growing and developing in this city or exactly anywhere in this country, I think a critical component remains building and sustaining our own business models, including businesses in the professional services. That is really critical. It's a way to not just build wealth, but it's a way to create opportunities that that are not necessarily
go ahead, write it wrong. Are we on air?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks. Okay. That's what we're talking about, international law. You guys had offices in various countries.
Right.
What is the importance of having a law firm that has international reach, representing entrepreneur-type business?
Well, it can be very helpful, and I don't think it's necessary. You can have a great law firm domestic, with just a domestic reach, or a great law firm that just focused on a city. But if you're one of the great things about having an international component to a law firm practice is the ability to build relationships with different kinds of companies that need your service, either outgoing or incoming, and also to keep abreast of developments, because we like to think that in this country, we're always ahead of the curve, but the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of innovation going on all over the world, and to the extent you have tentacles in different places, you can keep abreast of those developments and bring them into your practice or your area to make improvements as you see fit.
And also, isn't another reason to have be represented by such attorneys as you when you're in private practice that you have access to government agencies? I mean, the thing is, the guy that's maybe on 135th Street may could practice in court, he may could, but in terms of regulatory bodies, having those contacts, is that one of the also advantages that the public should look out for?
Well, certainly that's a great advantage, but that goes into figuring out if you're a consumer of legal services, what services you think you need, and the kind of areas you think you need to have exposure to, and then match that with the lawyers that you're talking with, because not every lawyer, even in a big law firm, will be capable of getting you in front of certain people. Depends on what their experience is, what their relationship base is, where they've been, what they've done. Now, I one of the reasons I was able to do some of the things I was able to do in my lifetime, in my career, wasn't just because I practiced law at a certain level, it was because I knew a bunch of people who trusted me based upon things that I did outside of law. So that's very important, and you can get somebody who's a lawyer very good technically, but if he doesn't know anybody and nobody trusts him, you're just paying for.
I hope you young people are listening, and this is a lecture I give often to African Americans. I mean, I'm just a general attorney, but particularly my own group. It's not enough to know how to do a certiorari or whatever legal document you have to produce. The question becomes, what relationships? And I think that's everything centers around relationships. And this is important, which I want to bring this back to. Why did you leave the private practice of law, probably very lucrative part that Brian and Kay, some people die and go to hell for? to be a partner at one of those firms, and you go to an agency like Daphne.
Well, you know what? I got to fill you in on my on the step I took between the two.
Okay.
Because when I got to Bryan Cave, my law practice morphed a little bit, and I became more of a counsel to businesses as a sort of an outside general counsel to businesses, primarily in the publishing and hospitality area, but also some other areas. And then there came a time when I got kind of antsy to flip over to the business side myself.
Project from here, right?
Yes.
You want to get a chair? Okay, take this one. Here. Like I'm playing with clouds, right? We were off the air. Dear listeners, we were out off the air for technical difficulties. And we're continuing our discussion with Paul T. Williams, president of New York State Dormitory Authority. Before we went off the air, I was beginning to ask you a question about the your transition
right.
From Bryan and Cave, and then you went to a boutique investment banking at the top of the boom of the investment banking business. Seemed like everybody was opening up offices at Paul's, and why not?
I did. I was chasing the business, and I learned the business. I became licensed at the highest level you can get licensed in the securities industry as a principal of the firm. And I worked in business for 4.5, almost 5 years, and decided that I actually didn't like the business. let me get out of that and regroup. But it's funny because what happened was that I went back into law, and I had a handful of clients and projects that I was working on. And then
you kept your hand in the law while you were at the investment banking firm.
Well, I always had relationships that I maintained, but these were really projects that I had been working on myself with a small group of people. But then what happened was, out of nowhere, we suddenly had a governor in the state of New York that happened to be a friend of mine named David Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
And when Governor Patterson first became governor, I, along with a number of other people who were friendly with him, reached out. And through my years in and around government, I knew one thing. I knew if he had any chance of being successful, he was going to need to have some good people around him. So I called him up and I volunteered to try to help him identify some people, and I was prepared to send him some names of people that I thought would be good for his administration. And in the context of doing that, the tables were reversed on me, and I was asked to come into the administration in the position that I hold now as president of DASNY. At the time the offer was made, I was really surprised, but as I thought about it, it was something too interesting and too exciting for me to reject, because how often does a man get to work for a governor that he knows in a position that he knows has hidden potential,
mm-hmm.
to be of significance in terms of some policy issues and directives that both the governor and I share. So that's how I got here at DASNY, and it's been great.
Are you plan to stay at DASNY, and do you see yourself being the practicing attorney again?
You know what? I have found that I really, really enjoy the management side of things. Not only enjoy it, I think I'm pretty good at it. And if and when I leave DASNY, I probably see myself pursuing management of public entity or some type of.
Would you accept the president of one of the major historical African American colleges?
I don't know. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. I am interested in your development again. Like I said, because most of the African American lawyers that graduate law school, elected office or judicial offices. And you are, by legal training, a litigator. Would you explain to our audience who may not know what a litigator is and the different areas of law, litigated versus transactional law?
Sure. Well, litigator is a fancy word for trial attorney, and you can have an expertise as a trial attorney, which means that you're capable of handling a lot of different cases, because each case will have its own particular subject matter. Might be contracts, might be fraud, might be anything. But if you're a trial attorney, that's a particular skill, expertise unto itself, where you school up on the subject matter of a case. But your forte is how do you deliver that case in court, and how do you develop the strategies in court to be successful, whether you're prosecuting a case or defending a case. Now, my work was all on what's called the civil side of the law. I didn't do any criminal work.
Explain to your audience, I may not understand the case law, may not understand the difference between civil and criminal law.
Mm-hmm. Well, criminal law is that part of the law that arises out of violations of the penal code, where typically it's going to be a person or corporation that's charged with some criminal offense. And there's a whole court system that's structured just to deal with criminal law. The other side of the law is civil law, dealing with basically commercial, non-criminal disputes. Could be contracts, could be matrimonials, could be landlord-tenant, could be real estate. But it's
well, you were at Ms. Walker's firm. Did you do? You did a little of everything.
I did do a little of everything, which was a great training ground, because that diversity of experience gives me perspectives.
And she was a good teacher.
That aren't necessarily shared with everybody else. Yeah, she was a great teacher. Well, I mean, her method was to throw you in, and you got good or you didn't.
Right. Yeah. And she didn't take a lot of no's for answers.
No.
And wanted things to be exactly right. I mean, she didn't take any shortcuts.
No.
I found her an interesting person to work for, but she was about giving you an opportunity, but you had to prove it.
Yes.
Which I think is part of life anyway, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And
it's a good way to learn. I mean, you don't want to be challenged.
Let's move towards to DASNY again and tell us when that agency kind of came into existence and how it works with the private and profit sector. Explain to us what it had worked with the non-governmental sector.
Okay.
For example, a hospital.
Sure.
Why would a hospital use DASNY?
Well, first of all, it's interesting because DASNY as an organization is 69 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's been around for a long time. But our mission has changed over that period of time. So we do much more now than what we did when we were created 69 years ago. In fact, the original name of the organization is the Dormitory Authority. You would think we spent a lot of time on dorms. Only 15% of what we actually do today relates to dormitories. But and a big part of what we do today does relate to the healthcare industry. And we do a couple of things. We help finance not-for-profit hospitals by being what's referred to as a conduit issuer for their bonds. So if Memorial Sloan Kettering wants to issue bonds to build a new wing on their hospital, they'll come to us, and we help facilitate getting those bonds to market with a team of underwriters.
So your investment banking business training really plays in very important.
Well, that's what I was going to tell you. That's why it was so interesting that I took that trip down on Wall Street as a banker. And even though I came to learn that I didn't like that business, having that experience was tremendously important in terms of me getting this job.
And banking is a very vital piece in business anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great, yeah. I mean, it's a great...
probably the other ingredient to law. I mean, you have to have a business be successful. If you, one doesn't have an investment banking and doesn't have a law firm, I mean, one is pretty much sort of up the creek without a paddle.
Well, it's an important area, and it's a huge area in New York City, where we're with capital finance, and so it's good to, that we have that kind of experience.
How many people work for you?
Daphne, we have just over 500 employees.
Okay. And they are in all, throughout the state or in Albany?
Yes, our main office is in Albany. Our second largest office is here in New York City. Mm-hmm. Then we have a small office in Buffalo. And then we have field sites where we're actually doing construction projects. Mm-hmm. We have field reps and other folks.
Do you travel throughout the state?
I do. That's one of the beautiful things about the jobs, giving me the opportunity to
and
travel.
And you see the greatness of New
far
York State.
Far and wide. Right. I love New York State, and it's a gorgeous, beautiful state. And, you know, we do a lot of work with the state university system. So I have visited a number of their campuses that are scattered all over the state. And
so you finance other private colleges?
Yes,
like
we
Columbia,
do.
They have finance. They do have finance in that dormitory.
Yep. Cornell, Columbia, Fordham, Yeshiva. We issue bonds for
and North Carolina Hospital, which was used to be an African American hospital. Well, I would say the African American hospital, but these are hospitals that was in our neighborhood.
Yes.
That was financed by that.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And we were critical in helping the transition of North General Hospital. Hospital had to close, and under the traditional way of looking at things, it just would have gone into bankruptcy, and at some point in time, the judge would have put the property up for sale, somebody would have bid on it, and that would be it. Property might still be sitting there undeveloped. But we wanted to see a different model, and with North General we were able to create a different model, a model that focused on the community and making sure that there were relevant services being provided for the community in healthcare, as well as looking at how to repurpose that property so that it didn't become a vacant shell, but was providing some economic sustenance.
How was it, a 200-bed hospital?
It was around a 200-bed hospital, but in place now we got a state-of-the-art federally qualified health center built up there. We had the City of New York Health and Hospitals Corporation come in and take over the main hospital and refurbish it as a long-term acute care facility. Mm-hmm. And we also got the city to build a brand new facility. Unfortunately, it's not a DASNY project, but to build a brand new facility on what was the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
to replace Goldwater Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
On Roosevelt Island. So we turned something that could have been a disaster into something that is a net benefit for that community when you add up all the pieces.
So you seem to be excited that working for DASNY, you see that it seems to be something that you're enjoying. I mean, you didn't enjoy the investment banking, but you see making a contribution.
Well, there's some exciting things going on.
Tell us about some of those things.
Well, we're getting ready to get involved in hopefully what are called the public-private partnerships, where instead of the state issuing bonds to pay for capital construction, we'll try to resource private capital and private expertise to do some of that, to build one or more facilities. They're doing it already with traditional infrastructure. Tappan Zee Bridge is a type of public-private mm-hmm. partnership. They just bid out the Gothels.
And your agencies would be responsible.
Not the roadways and the tunnels and bridges,
but
we're focusing on what's called social infrastructure,
okay.
Vertical construction, buildings like labs or hospitals or schools that might benefit from that kind of process, dorms even. So
what about group homes and those kind of things?
Yeah, possibly that too. You know. So we're looking at a range of asset classes to see whether
now,
or not
would,
we might have a role.
Would juvenile detention facilities come under your agency? I mean, it's the Department of Juvenile Justice, but, for example, private contracts.
Right.
Looking here at these two law enforcement men, and I think we could do a pretty good job of turning people around. We did a job of turning Minister Malcolm and a lot of others around.
Mm-hmm.
I tell young people, I said, look, young man, I can do something with you. We took a man that was a second-rate criminal and sent him to Oxford. not that that's our main population, but I think we have some expertise. I really offer people from the state are listening, and people from the Department of Justice are listening.
Right.
I think we should be, people should be contracting with us to help.
Well, I think that there's certainly the need, and where there's need, there might be opportunity. We're not directly involved in that side of social services, but there are obviously agencies at the state level that are, and I think there's no harm in making your interests known to those folks who have jurisdiction over those areas. One thing about Governor Cuomo's administration is that he himself is very innovative. I think the administration is being innovative in a number of ways. So I would never say never. I think people need to develop their ideas and find the right entry points to introduce them, and you never know what happens.
Let me ask you this. One of the questions I had sent to you to ask you was, your father was a practicing physician. I assume he was a private practitioner. Did that have any influence upon your being decided to be an entrepreneur? Because you're quite an entrepreneur. I mean, the average brother would just look for a job in one of the big law firms, lasted 7 years, and generally back out the streets
right.
again to practice.
Right. No, you know, I mean, you're right about that. It did have some influence on me because I viewed my father as a business person. He was a physician, but he had his private practice. He worked exceedingly hard at it, and over the period of time that he worked his practice, there were a couple of things that I took away from that, good or bad. One thing I took away was that I always felt that he could have been more successful in working with others than retaining his individual practice. So in my mind, whenever I thought about doing something in business, I always said to myself, you need to consider partners and partnerships rather than just the solo route. And then the other thing that I saw with working with my dad was that you had to always keep your mind open for opportunities. Because you would never know when the right opportunity would come to you. So if you weren't open to opportunity all the time, you might miss the one that was meant for you. So those are two takeaways from that.
And you learned to move and to shift. I mean, obviously you had a spirituality to say, okay, I can start at Coral Walker's Law Firm, get out of Columbia. By the track that you came on, you were supposed to be, you know, the Bible will name the firm. Some of them are no longer in existence.
Right.
But, you know, that's the track that brothers dream of, and
right.
people in general dream of.
Right.
You come downtown to Harlem, it's noisy. Right. You had 123rd Street at Coral Walker's office.
Right.
And then you go out, strike out on your own, and form a firm. What would you say to a young brother just getting out of law school now? A sister.
Right.
What advice would you give them?
Well, my advice would be pretty simple. Number one, focus on your craft. People don't understand that when I came out of law school, went to work for Coral Walker, I didn't do anything for about 4 years except practice law day in, day and night, weekends. And
does she have a criminal practice too?
She had
a little bit
of one. That was not her forte.
No, I know. She could tolerate those type of things.
That was not her forte.
But she did send you court on those cases.
Well, you know, one time we had a big criminal case out in Chicago.
Yeah.
Because this was just at the tail end of the original Mayor Daley administration. And they were locking up everybody. And there was a brother who had been taxi commissioner. And apparently he knew Cora or whatever, and so he called her out there. He didn't trust anybody locally to represent him, so he called on Cora to represent him out there, and we went out there and tried a big federal court criminal case. And so she had a little bit of criminal practice, but
she didn't represent Amtrak.
That was her forte. I mean, her strength was on commercial litigation as a trial lawyer, And she had a tremendous practice representing Conrail.
Yeah, real bold. I mean,
then Amtrak.
Very bold lady. I mean, some journalist. What are you young people out here? One of you old people out here should write a book on Cora Walker too. A legendary lawyer, mixed it up on 25th Street.
Yeah.
Didn't wasn't afraid. Was not intimidated.
Right.
Talked to you around on the street. Asked tenants to pay the rent. You know, I mean, she was a kind of
yeah,
she was
no,
a character.
She was a character, and she was one of a kind.
Yeah.
And she somebody should do a book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this. You know, when we look at men like John L. Edmonds and those types of people, because it infuses you with your history, not the other people do it. I mean, this stuff. I want to get back to the dormitory authority. I don't want to hold you a few more minutes.
Right.
And before we just take a few questions from the audience. What do you see as the future for the Dormitory Authority? Give us like maybe 3 years, not where you all going.
Well, I think what we're going to do, we're going to continue to develop new finance programs. One of the things we did recently was we created a new bond program to finance dormitories for the state of New state university system. We're looking at initiating additional programs that can be useful to the state and its agencies in the area of bond finance. We will be involved in public-private partnerships as a technical advisor to public agencies that want to try to develop projects in that capacity. And we're going to continue to work hard to not only expand but also improve our utilization of minority women-owned firms. One of the things we're working on is a strategy to try to help grow more firms to scale. It's one of the big concerns that many of us have as public builders. There's a lot of work coming down the pike, but the concern is the scalability of some of our firms and whether or not we can get folks to a certain level of capacity where they can ultimately become prime contractors. And really take down a larger share of the
market. So you see your
market.
Agency is being not an incubator, but an agency that also will help in developing companies come up to snuff, to use a colloquial expression, so they can compete as business here.
Yes, that's one of our objectives, and we have yet, you know, we're in the process of trying to build out a programmatic approach to that effect.
We have a live audience. Is anybody in the audience like to ask questions? Joe, you go to the phones and see if there's anybody want to ask questions. We're going to give them a few more minutes. We're going to have to go home and enjoy his day.
My question is...
state your name and...
Okay, my name is Ismail Fadal from LDS Security, CFO. My question is, what is the percentage of minority participation most construction projects?
Okay. You know, what's amazing is that over the last 5 years I've been president of DASNY, we've spent more money in construction in this state than in any other five-year period.
Yes,
this last fiscal year, we spent over $1 billion on projects across the state of New York. And we spent between $800 million and $1 billion each of these other prior years. We have a goal, an overall authority goal of achieving a minimum of 20% utilization of minority women-owned firms. And each year that I've been here, we've exceeded that goal. Now, what specific projects will have specific goals? So, for example, on our projects downstate, we tend to have higher goals than 20% because we know, first of all, we know there's capacity downstate. Some projects upstate, we may have a lower goal because there are fewer firms that are available to work on some projects upstate. So I know on Harlem Hospital, I think we did 42%. On Medgar Evers, you know, we are going to do... a very high percentage. I'm not sure off the top of my head. But most of the New York City projects, we will come in somewhere around 30% utilization, if not better. And when you roll it all up, this last fiscal year we did 21.67% utilization
okay.
of minority and women-owned firms, which is it's a very good record, considering that it's you know, takes extra work to make sure
yes.
you can get to that level. But we, you know, we're committed to doing it. As I said, one of the reasons we want to do this initiative in scalability of firms is that we're a little concerned as we move further out in time about the diminishing number of minority women-owned firms that qualify as prime contractors, either as GCs or CMs. And we probably need to do something about that to try to ensure that we can continue to generate those kinds of numbers in terms of utilization.
I wanted to ask a question in reference to what you just got been saying. Having more firms, more minority firms, come to scale. Is it from your experience? How would you advise up-and-coming or new businesses, new structure firms? Firms, how would you advise them navigating to first of all start or get involved in construction and then move up to what you call scale?
Right.
Scale level.
Well, you know, there's really not a lot of magic about building a business. It's hard, and not everybody can do it. But there's some very, I think, obvious building blocks. One is you got to know what the hell you're doing. You know, so you got to be good at what you do, and there's really no substitute for that. You need to have the right book of relationships, and then a third piece that oftentimes gets lost in the translation is that you need to really run a business. So, for example, you can be a great bricklayer as a skill, but if you're going to build a business as a bricklayer, then you have to have the right business acumen. So you have to have the right legal organization. You have to have the right books of account. You have to have the right contracts, and you have to know how to use all those things to benefit your... You have to have the right marketing materials, and you have to be prepared to spend money on those things, and you have to be prepared to save money to support yourself and your business when there are downtimes. And those are the key ingredients. And if people can get those things done, you can ultimately grow your business over time. But you can't grow your business with somebody else's money. You have to grow your business with your own money, and then once you do that, you'll attract other capital. So it's, in my mind, it's not, I mean, the ingredients for building a business are known worldwide. In our community, unfortunately, we forget about, you know, investing in self. And we forget sometimes about the technical parts around how you account for your business and how you account for your legal relationships via contracts and whatnot. We need to pay better attention to that. That's why we started a surety bond assistance program at DASNY now 2.5 years ago, because a lot of construction firms complained that it was hard for them to get access to bonding capacity. So we created a program, and it became very successful, and through that program, the firms that were admitted to that program, we generated something like $53 million in either new bond capacity or expanded bond capacity. And we didn't have to, meaning DASNY, we didn't have to underwrite any of that, even though I had gotten our board to commit a couple million dollars toward potentially underwriting some of those bonds ourselves. We didn't have to touch any of our own money. Why? Because ultimately, it was about those firms going through an educational program to understand how to build out their business, and then building relationships with some of the surety firms that were involved in the program. And it was successful just with those two things. But the thing that the sureties wanted to know wasn't just that, you know, John Doe was a great painter, but that, you know, John Doe knew how to take care of his accounts receivables, his payables, how to structure his relationships with his staff, that he had the right support and things of that nature. So through this program, through the Surety Bond Assistance Educational Program, firms went through a fairly rigorous course of instruction in all those back office areas. And once they graduated from that course, the sureties had more confidence in them as businesses and were able to feel more comfortable about either giving bonding authority or expanding bonding authority with these firms. So it's doable, but, you know, I guess the only other thing I would say is that, you have to have a passion about your business because it doesn't happen overnight, and it requires a lot of work.
Now, one question that's not related to Destiny, related to your own work, was this work that you pioneered in gun violence and reducing the violence. Are you still involved in that? And if you are still involved, and back up that, as an attorney that lives in a nice neighborhood, why would you be concerned about that?
Well, I grew very concerned about gun violence. About, I don't know, 2 years or so ago, you know, sort of visceral way. I've always had general concern about conditions in our community, but in a real visceral way, when a story emerged about some youngster, and I can't even remember who it was as I'm sitting here now, getting shot, who clearly had a promising future, and got shot and taken away from us, not because of anything he was doing or not doing, but because some other folks decided they wanted to try to shoot each other, and because they were not proficient at shooting their own firearms, they ended up killing these innocent young men and women.
Very reminiscent of what happened Mother's Day in New Orleans and the 19,000
right.
shootings that took place in Chicago and the 500 murders and
right.
these kind of things.
So my concern, you know, came from seeing that over and hearing about it over and over again and recognizing that there are lots of problems with it, but one of the problems was too many damn guns,
mm-hmm.
right? And how do you just address that issue? Then the other problem is how do you address the issue about who's using them and whether you can change that mindset?
Right.
So a group of men got together to try to focus on that. We had developed some clear ideas to try to turn the tide in a couple of precincts, specific precincts in Harlem, where the violence was predominant, and then this whole thing with Newtown, Connecticut happened and sort of, you know, put things on a whole different kind of perspective. But our issues on the street are still the same, and they're
yeah.
still there. So that particular initiative isn't ongoing as a unified initiative, but the men who are involved are still doing things.
We will have another conversation about that, but I really want to push that idea. Well, I'm affiliated with an organization. My leader here is Father, Son, Men, Voice Association, Brother Dave Shacker, who runs an organization for the last 16 years that mentors young men, but fathers with sons and brothers, doesn't have fathers. We also, every year, have an annual family day. Mm-hmm. We have a family day with about 10,000 people. I don't know what Daphne can participate in. Certainly we call you for a brochure on the 100 Black Men. But we want to build this as a movement.
Yep.
You know, there's a fellow I know, 40 years, unfortunately, I won't name him on the air. Brought a million men someplace in America. I wanted to give him up, but and did really nothing with him. And what I want to do, and that's why this alliance with the business people, is to start a movement to get our men to be nonviolent towards each other. I think, you know, and I mean,
you got to get the violence out of the culture.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
And until we get more serious about policing our culture, it's very hard. You know, people ask me all the time, well, you know, why do you think, you know, why are you so hard on gangster rap culture and the violence that a lot of our popular artists portray? And, you know, that's not causing this stuff. And my retort is, that damn sure is causing this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, people don't read books because they don't have any impact. They read books because they do have impact. You don't look at a screen 24/7 that denigrates your women, that portrays you as criminals and violent people, and not take anything away from it.
Right.
You know, if it's so irrelevant to anything, then why don't we see it in anybody else's culture?
Wow.
You know, I don't see it repeated in anybody else's culture in this country except black folks, and it's a degradation to us as a people, and we promote it like it's water, you know, out the faucet.
And so it's unspoken. It's the 10,000-ton gorilla in the world. We don't want to discuss it. You come up in political meetings, you go to black Puerto Rican caucuses, and we don't want to address it.
I hear you, and that to me is a very, very troubling. And you know,
I mean, people like your dad, they saw a young man, maybe he'd be coming, I'm an African American cop, they come to your house and they see you in disrepair psychologically, physically. They say, well, young man, come here, let me speak to you a minute. Okay. So I'm here to see your mom, but you know, about the blood pressure, but you're the one driving the blood pressure up. I had a physician, African American physician, to tell us that. We have to get more involved and show investment in our people. And you know, the young boy that may be in Grant Projects, that's a duck of building, could end up being a Harvard-trained lawyer.
Absolutely.
If he's given the opportunity.
And that's the tragedy of the assault on particularly young men of color in this country. And that's one reason why I helped start, as president of Black Men, the Eagle Academy Foundation.
Yes, yes, yes.
One of the first.
Are you still the president of Black Men?
No, I'm not president of 100 Black Men. I'm on the Eagle Academy Foundation, where I'm still involved with 100.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's a model where it's a traditional public school for all boys. We go from 6th through 12. But we, you know, through the Eagle Academy Foundation, we wrap that school with the kinds of things that it needs to sustain these boys and grow them into proficient men with a value system and structure. Mentoring is a big part of it, but it's not the only part of it. But that's what's needed, because if we can't save our sons in particular, the girls are doing pretty well, Tayasa, but we can't save our sons, we will be losing too much valuable human capital. And that doesn't impact just people sitting around in Harlem or Bed-Stuy. That impacts the ability of this city and of this country to manifest itself at its highest level.
Yes.
And if we're not doing that, you can best believe there are other countries who are. That's why you have the competition from China, the competition from India, even the competition from Europe, because their cultures are saying, we're going to maximize 99% of who we are. And in this culture, for some reason, in this country, too many people settle for 70% and think they can write off the rest. And when they write off the rest, they're writing themselves off.
That's right. Now, let me ask you this. Tell our audience, you're a member of 100 Black Men, you're one of the property founders. What is the 100 Black Men and why are they?
100 Black Men is a really neat organization of generally professional men that started officially in 1963, although it really started before then. And the neat thing about it is that it's men from all different backgrounds and professions and area of work. So it's not just lawyers or doctors or teachers or priests or preachers. It's everybody. And I think the one common chord is that folks, they're men who have an interest and commitment to contributing back to society in some measure to help advance our community in ways that that are needed.
Any other question? I know we want to close this out. Questions from the audience? Going, or is it? We thank again for Paul Williams, of the president of the New York State Dormitory Authority, for gracing our audience with his presence. We hope to another time you'll come back. Perhaps when it's snow up in Albany and you want to get back to New York. We thank you again. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened to, once again, another edition of Religion Means Alive. Tomorrow, I'm surrounded by attorneys. Tomorrow, Brother Imam Abdul Salam, Yusuf Abdul Salam, the attorney in Selma, Alabama, will be our guest. And he's going to continue his dialogue addressing these issues. And in fact, we're planning 2015, the anniversary of Selma. And we're going to talk about the other side of Pettus Bridge. And one of the other sides of Pettus Bridge is where we go. Where are we going to go as a people? The bringing together of the national, the two forces, Dr. King and the nationalist forces together as one to make ourselves competitive citizens in America. So that should be an exciting program. Thank you. Peace be on our noble and honorable list from the audience. And see you again. Thanks.
There you go.